Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Lynn Nesner, attorney registration 39209. I'm here on behalf of the defendant appellant, Mr. Justin Taylor. I would like to reserve a few minutes for rebuttal. I'm going to be addressing the third issue in the opening brief, which concerns errors in the court's instructions. I've brought extra copies of the court's instructions if this court would like to glance at them during the oral argument.
We have copies of those,
okay. Counsel. Thank you. The instructions in this case had three fundamental flaws that require reversal. First, the instructions as a whole did not inform the jury that the prosecution's burden included proving not just the abusive act, but the causal link between the act and the harm to the child. In People v. Dunaway, the Supreme Court made clear that causation is an element of the state's burden. The Supreme Court found that the child abuse statute specifically requires the prosecution to prove the causal link or how the act of child abuse caused the charged harm or injury to the child. In Dunaway, the state accused the defendant of shaking a baby and charged him under the same two theories of liability that were charged here. Those being that defendant committed an act of child abuse by one, causing the injury, or two, by placing the child to be in an unreasonably at risk. This Supreme Court refers to the second theory of liability as an endangerment theory. In considering the sufficiency of the evidence under both theories of liability, the Supreme Court found that Dunaway's delay of an hour and a half in failing to obtain medical care for the infant provided sufficient evidence of endangerment, but the state failed to prove the causal link between the endangerment and the infant's serious bodily injury.
Counsel, in this case, we've got a child who died, and the child's death is certainly not in dispute. And given that we're not dealing with a situation where the degree of harm to the child is that issue, why would any error in failing to instruct the jury on the fact of the injury and the fact that it had to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, why wouldn't that be harmless error here under these facts?
You're right, Your Honor, that there's no dispute that the infant unfortunately passed away. But the central issue was what caused the death. The defense put on experts who described how the child had underlying pre-existing health issues, like subdural evidence of a chronic subdural hematoma, and that the child had extra axial spaces or fluid on his brain. And there was evidence that infants with this disorder are more susceptible to brain bleeds upon minor trauma or spontaneous rebleeding. So that was the central dispute at trial. Was it the actions of Mr. Taylor that caused the child's death, or was it the child's underlying pre-existing health issues? And the court's instructions in three different ways really fundamentally took away the causation finding from the jury. So first, they weren't informed that causation was part of the burden. It's not included in the elemental, and the defense tendered instructions, they would have specifically told the jury that causation is part of the prosecution's burden of proof under both theories of liability. Obviously, if the jury had chosen the first theory of liability, the defendant caused injury, then we wouldn't have so much harm. But here, they specifically rejected that theory of liability.
Ms. Nesner, to follow on my colleague's question to you, recognizing that the verdict forms are not a substitute for the instructions, nevertheless, in light of the instructions as a whole and the explanation to the jury that the prosecution has the burden of proof in all matters, wasn't the jury's election on the verdict form that the defendant's action caused the death of the child, doesn't that make it harmless here?
The jury's finding is inherently unreliable. It's actually a product of the errors in the verdict form. It doesn't cure the problems. It's the product of the error, because the verdict form, this is the second problem, is that if you look at the Colgi instructions, the model instructions, which are the preferred pattern instruction for use in Colorado, they have a threshold question. So the jury gets to decide here where the state has charged two different theories of liability for child abuse. After they decide that, they get to decide, regardless of the theory regarding the act of child abuse, did the prosecution prove the causal link between the act and the harm to the child? So they're, and before they decide the degree of injury. And what the court did was remove that causal question, which is the threshold, critical, most disputed. I mean, that was the dispute at trial. That was Mr. Taylor's defense. That was the only thing that mattered at trial, was what was the cause of his death. And that was what the jury didn't find, because the court took out that causal interrogatory, did the defendant cause injury, and just asked them to find the degree of injury in a case where there's no dispute as to what happened to the child. And all three options that they were given included causal language: defendant caused death, caused serious bodily injury, caused injury. They weren't given the option that is included in Colgi, the defense asked for, which would have been no harm, that the prosecution did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the state proved defendant's actions caused the death of the child. That was the option they were not given. So we cannot assume anything, because they found one of three where one was obvious, in light of their, it was a directed finding where they were only given the option to find harm. They weren't given the option to find, no, the state didn't prove that the act of child abuse caused the harm. Under the endangerment theory of liability, there is no causal language, if that makes sense. There's nothing directly suggesting that the prosecution has a burden to prove causation. So under the theory of liability that they chose, they were never told that that was part of the prosecution's burden. And then once they found that that was the theory of liability, I mean, they specifically rejected that the state proved that the defendant caused an injury. They rejected that as the basis for the child abuse conviction. Then they were told they had to pick one of three options that all assumed cause. There was no space for them to say, we think he's guilty of some act of child abuse, but we do not think that his act of endangering the child was the ultimate cause of the child's death. And there was evidence to support a potential finding of lesser culpability. I mean, in Dunaway, they found that evidence, that Mr. Dunaway waiting an hour and a half to obtain medical care would have supported the jury's finding of endangerment. Here we have similar evidence that Mr. Taylor, put the child down for a nap and waited potentially 2 hours, before the mother came home and they alerted 911. So the jury may have found that he endangered the child by not immediately seeking medical attention.
But counsel, pardon me, didn't he, or in his statement, there was evidence that he dropped the child, and I don't think that's disputed. So really, was there any evidentiary basis for a no injury instruction?
Dropping the child would be a direct injury. So this child abuse statute requires an act of child abuse, that's under subsection 1A, and here it was, you could either cause an injury or endanger the child, and then here requires the cause between the act and the injury. The prosecution has to prove that. So, I mean, here the jury specifically did not find that his act caused injury. They did not mark that box. They were given the option to find both, and they did not find that option. So their verdict form shows that they believe he endangered the child. Was there evidence that he injured the child? Yes, his statements were that he accidentally dropped the child. So there was evidence to support a potential finding, but that's not what the jury found here. What the jury found here was that they left that box blank. They only selected the endangerment theory, and then they were forced to find. They could not find that the state hadn't proved cause. I mean, the problem is that they should have been asked after they chose which act. Okay, under this theory of liability that you've chosen, the endangerment theory, do you find that the state proved that the defendant's act caused the ultimate death here? And they weren't given the option to decide that. They were forced to choose between one of three options where it's pretty obvious and all the language assumes cause. So it's not really, no, there's no dispute over the degree of injury, or was there evidence support that causation? Yes, but what they found was, we don't find that he committed child abuse by directly causing an injury. We find he committed the act of child abuse by placing him at risk. I think under that theory, the state didn't provide a lot of evidence that his act of endangerment, be it failing to seek medical attention or, you know, leaving the child sort of unsupervised on the floor while the toddler is playing. I mean, these are things that the jury may have believed endangered the child, but there wasn't evidence placed. The state's primary theory was that he caused an injury, that he shook the baby. They didn't put on a lot of evidence that his acts of endangerment are what caused the baby's death. So if they rejected that his act was shaking the baby, then there is evidence there is support that they could find. We don't think his act of endangering the child, while he might have done something criminal the jury might not have agreed with, they might not have found him guilty of causing the death. I'm going to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nesner.
May it please the court. My name is Erin Grundy, registration number 41271, and I represent the people. In this case, the instructions, when considered as a whole, adequately informed the jury that it was required to find proof beyond a reasonable doubt of every element of the charged crime, as well as the level of the offense, essentially the sentence enhancers that are present in this case. The jury was instructed that it had to find every element of knowing or reckless child abuse in the specific instruction. That instruction is consistent with the Colchi. So in terms of knowing or reckless child abuse, there's no dispute here that the jury was accurately instructed that it had to find that the defendant placed the child in a situation since they went with the endangerment. Pardon me. Since the jury selected the endangerment clause, that the defendant knowingly placed the child in a situation that unreasonably caused a risk to his health or life.
Ms. Grundy, but under the Colorado Supreme Court's authority in Beagle v. People, it seems to me that we have no option but to reverse. What guarantee do we have that the jury understood that it had to conclude beyond a reasonable doubt both that the defendant caused the injuries to the child and that if he did so, you know, what the degree of injury was, again, beyond a reasonable doubt? I just don't see very much difference between our situation here with Mr. Taylor and the Beagle situation.
Well, if we look at the situation here, we see that the jury was instructed that it had to find every element beyond a reasonable doubt. Certainly, it would have been better practice had the jury received essentially the intermediate box on the verdict form to check, did the defendant cause injury? What's distinguishable here from the cases cited by the defendant, and particularly Dunaway, is that the actual selection in the special interrogatory includes the causation language. So we see that the jury actually selected that the defendant caused the death of the child. And there's no reasonable probability here that the jury would have been able to part and parcel the instructions as a whole to determine that it could apply a lesser degree, a lesser burden of proof on the prosecution in one aspect of the verdict than it did on the others. So in this case, if we look at the instructions as a whole, we see that the jury selected the most serious offense in two contexts. First, it selected that the defendant committed knowing or reckless child abuse, rather than committing criminally negligent child abuse. Second, the jury selected that the defendant caused the death of the child. Now, many of the situations posited by the defense, that perhaps the defendant dropped the child, but it was actually the underlying medical conditions that caused the death. If that were the case, if that was what the jury believed, the jury would have selected that the defendant caused bodily injury, because his actions would not have ultimately resulted in the child's death. But we see from the jury's actual finding in this case, and the causation language that was included in the verdict form, that they selected the most serious offense. And Mata Medina tells us when there's a failure to give that lesser offense, and the jury rejects the intermediate offenses and instead convicts on the most serious offense, any error in failure to give that lesser offense is harmless. Yes, Your Honor.
Excuse me for interrupting.
Pardon me.
Your thought process. The causation here is an enhancer.
Right.
And moves it from F3 to an F2?
Well, it moves it from the M1 is causing no injury to the F2 is causing death, with F6 being causing bodily injury and F3 causing SBI.
So there's no way to send it back for a lesser felony because you don't know what lesser felony might be applicable.
That's correct, Your Honor. In this case, however, any error in failing to instruct is harmless, given the jury's conviction for the most serious offense. And again, this case is distinguishable from Dunaway. There, the Supreme Court specifically noted that there was no evidence in the case that the causation could have caused the death of the child. In this case, there was that evidence. Dr. Narang specifically testified on June 16, 2010, page 55 of the transcript, that waiting hours to respond could significantly impact the child's outcome. Here, we have the testimony that was concerning to the court that was missing in Dunaway. We also have that specific finding of causation. The jury did elect the defendant caused the child's death on the verdict form. And the instructions as a whole informed the jury of the prosecution's burden of proof.
Ms. Grundy, excuse me. So the instructions you're relying on are the general burden of proof, because the act is instruction is just the act. There's nothing wrong with that. It's based on the statute. But there is no separate instruction anywhere on the enhancement elements.
That's
so correct. You're presuming that the jury would know to take the general burden of proof instruction and apply it to an enhancement element, even though the verdict form itself says nothing about beyond a reasonable doubt. Is that your thought process?
Yes, Your Honor. And also, if you notice, if you look specifically to the defendant's proposed verdict form, you'll see that that verdict form also does not include beyond a reasonable doubt. So what was actually proposed to the jury did not include a finding of beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, the people agree that the defendant's proposed instruction, which was not given, did include that language, but the actual verdict form, the actual complaint on appeal that the verdict form was not given, was that would not have corrected this issue either had the verdict form been given that the defendant proposed.
Can you point us to any authority then where a general burden of proof instruction is sufficient on an Apprendi issue?
Your Honor, I don't believe that we've necessarily addressed this specific question before. Now, we saw from the Supreme Court case this morning that Ms. Nesner submitted the supplemental authority on, that we know that if a jury acquits of the predicate offense and then convicts only on the interrogatory, that's insufficient. But again, that's just not the situation we have here. So we know that the jury was instructed that it had to find every element beyond a reasonable doubt. We know that it found a guilty verdict on that predicate offense. We know that every party, the defense, the prosecution, and the court repeatedly instructed the jury that it had to find every element beyond a reasonable doubt. Well, we know the language of the elemental instruction, and we know that those are the elements of the offense and the others are sentence enhancers. There's no reasonable probability that the jury would have given disparate treatment to those that created the level of offense versus those that created the elements of the offense. And there was no suggestion in closing argument, in opening statements, or anywhere along the case that the jury could convict for less than beyond a reasonable doubt for any portion of this offense, including those that create the enhancement. And if we look at LePage, the Court of Appeals opinion in LePage tells us that when the jury submits questions of the court, which it did here in requesting the video, the jury has indicated that it understands the instructions, that it doesn't have questions, and that if it did, it would have asked them, and that an error in the verdict form doesn't indicate confusion by the jury. That's what we have here. The jury asked questions. The jury was instructed on the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The jury selected that the defendant was guilty of the predicate offense of knowing or reckless child abuse, and then it determined causation and that the defendant caused death. We don't have the situation present in Dunaway, and while it certainly would have been better practice for the court to give the intermediate option for the jury to select it, by actually indicating that the defendant caused death, which was absent from Dunaway, the jury has made sufficient findings to demonstrate that it believed that the defendant committed knowing or reckless child abuse resulting in the death of this child.
Indeed, all the judge had to do here was give an oral explanation to the jury that they had to find the enhancer beyond a reasonable doubt. He didn't have to submit a written instruction to them, but he didn't even do that.
No, Your Honor, he didn't. It wasn't requested by either party that he give such an oral instruction, and the judge was under the impression that there was no support in this case that the defendant caused no injury, and that does appear to be accurate from the evidence. There's not even the defendant's experts testified that the child spontaneously died. There had to be some triggering event. So even if the defendant caused injury, and the child's underlying medical conditions actually resulted in death, there was no support for the least included offense that the defendant caused no injury to this child, or that the child spontaneously died from other injuries. And in this case, the instructions adequately informed the jury of what it needed to find. And if this court has no further questions on this or the other issues in this case, the people respectfully request that this court affirm the judgment of conviction.
Thank you, Ms. Grundy. Ms. Nesner?
In Apprendi v. New Jersey, the Supreme Court held that it is unconstitutional to remove from the jury the assessment of facts that increase the prescribed range of penalties to which a criminal defendant is exposed. It is equally clear that such facts must be established by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I mean, I think here you have the causation, the jury being misinformed or not told that is part of the prosecution's burden in any kind of clear, specific way. And it was included in the defense explanatory instruction that followed Colgi. It was not evident in any of the instructions tendered by the court. And then you also have the court removing their finding because the three options that the court gave the jury all included the causal language. And so the finding is not reliable. It's not like the jury found that he caused the death. The jury was not given the option to find no harm. That is why this case is distinguishable from Madam Medina, where we can assume something because the jury rejected an intermediate finding. Here, they should have been given the option to find something different and mutually exclusive from the three options. Harm, of course they're gonna choose death, or no harm, that's a different question than degrees of harm. The no harm is what the defense asked the court to instruct the jury, and what they were not given the option to find anywhere on the verdict form once they expressly rejected the act being one of direct cause and chose the endangerment theory.
Counsel, given that it's the defendant that's the only individual that's on trial, not any other entity or any other person, can't we draw the inference that they connected, you know, whether, you know, it was the lesser mens rea, not intentional, but, you know, that he did not take due care with this child, but that he nevertheless, that his actions nevertheless resulted in the child's death? Can't we assume that that's effectively what the jury was concluding?
Well, in Dunaway, the Supreme Court made clear you cannot infer proof of the injury from proof of the act. It has to be separate. So here the jury did clearly find that he endangered the child, but they did not find that he caused the injury. So they we have an inconsistent finding here. And if they've been given the fourth different option to find no harm, they could have potentially found a consistent finding. I don't think you cannot make the jump that just because they found an act of child abuse and here the baby died, that is sufficient, especially when you have these three errors working together of, you know, the jury was misinformed about the prosecution's burden, the jury was not given the causal question, the central question of did he cause the injury, and then the jury was forced to make one of three findings that all assumed cause, that encompassed the causal finding. It's a directed finding, and there was evidence to support, and then there was evidence to support a potential, because the evidence regarding the baby's death was so disputed, there was evidence that they could potentially say, well, we don't find beyond a reasonable doubt, we think shaken baby is poor science or disputed, or there was reason to believe that they could have found a different cause for the child's death. So we would ask that you reverse his conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nesner. Thank you again, Ms. Grundy. Your arguments were excellent this afternoon. I think they were helpful to the court. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.